welcome to the Backstory Podcast. I'm your host, Colby Kolb. And today on the show, we have one of these people that I call a creative titan, an entrepreneur, a label leader, executive, CEO, boss, and one of the few people in this business that really put a stamp in hip hop. And that is Mr. Steve Rifkin. Welcome to the Backstory, my friend.
Man, thank you. Thank you.
Good to see you, man. Listen, I there's two things that inspired me to talk to you, because I've known you from, I remember when you started your promotion company before you even had the label, because you had one of my classmates was Han Sol, which was one of the first artists that you had signed. Yes. So that's how I found out about you. And then you had my guy, Fade DuVernay, working for you. You know, we were all just kids, man, just kind of starting out in the business. But you have created an incredible legacy, and watching the BET Hip Hop Awards this year and they honored Loud Records, it really just brought back so much goosebumps, because there was so much of a movement you created. So let's take a little walk back. You're from Long Island, and you really have the music business in your blood because your father was a label owner. So talk a little bit about growing up in Long Island and your dad and Spring Records, right? That was the label that your dad had?
Yeah, my dad had Spring Records. I actually just revamped Spring with my son Alex, and it's called Spring Sound. But, you know, growing up in Long Island, it was great. You know, my dad was in the music business. Rich Isaacson and my brother were my partners in Loud. Rich lived around the corner from us, you know, and Loud was a spinoff of really the promotion company, which was the Steven Rifkin Company.
Yeah.
But growing up, I never knew what the day would bring in Long Island, just who would be at the house, who would not be at the house. My father's going out of town, you know, and the characters that were going in and out of the house, like, is the house going to get shot up? Is it not going to get shot up? You know, the childhood was truly amazing.
So yeah, you had folks like James Brown. Like, your dad worked with a lot of really cool people. So like, you must have seen a lot of great things just growing up. And was that the bug that was like, I want to do this?
Nah, man. So I got the bug in my 20s, but what happened was I was dyslexic as a kid, right? So I didn't know how to read or write till I was 14 years old. So, you know, I thought I was going to be a professional basketball player. But at the end of the day, I was getting in a lot of trouble. And I was doing it. I didn't need to do it to survive. I mean, I grew up, you know, privileged. And I was just doing it to get attention, you know. But it really was going to a dark road. And my grandfather, who was, you know, the leader of the whole family, called me down to Florida. And, you know, in those days, I was now around 17, 18. He was the only one I was truly petrified of.
Right.
And he called me down to Florida and he says, you're going to end up dead or in jail. Like, I did it because I had to open up. You know, I just, you know, came from Europe, and don't do what I do. And that's not you. I go, well, what should I do? I'm not going to be a basketball player. He didn't even, you know, he wasn't a sports guy. And he goes, go do what your cousin did. I'm like, what, you know, one's a lawyer, but I'm like, what does Randy do? And Randy at that time was, I'm not saying head of promotion, but he was a national promotion guy at Polydor. I go, well, what is that? He goes, they visit radio stations. So I go, who's going to like do that? He goes, I'll talk to your father. And I'm like, man, Grandpa, my dad ain't going to want, you know, he's not going to trust me with anything. He tries to lock me out of the fucking house, you know.
Right.
So, like, 4 or 5 days later, don't forget, there were no cell phones. This is 1979, and the house phone rang, and I answered the phone. He goes, go pick me up at the airport. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, I'm landing in 3 hours. Pick me up at the airport. And I remember it was Eastern Airlines, and I pick him up. He says, we're going into the city. So I thought they were allowing me in the family, in his family business, right? I was so excited, and we ended up just going to my dad and uncle's office, and they pretty much said, we're going to give you an opportunity, and you're going to go on the road for like 3 weeks, and you're going to go visit radio stations. And I was like, all right, don't forget, you know, there was no GPS, there wasn't anything. It's like I had to call, you know, they gave me like $20 worth of quarters or dimes, you know, so I could call you and say, hey, Colb, I'm in New Jersey, like, and you in Philly, you know, like, how do I, you know, and I still wish I had that notebook of every direction on what freeway to take and how to get from one station to another. So make a long story short, that 3 weeks lasted 3 years. And that's when I, you know, I learned how to live on my own. I was living in hotels, and it was probably the happiest time of my life. And I stayed out of trouble.
So after that 3 years, is that when you start your own company, or what's the next step for you?
So I'm 21, 22 years old. My friends that I went to high school with, were just graduating college, and a friend of mine who is actually going to law school, Crush Groove came out. What year was Crush Groove?
That was 84.
So I was 22. And I called up Russell. I said, man, let's do a cartoon show. And Lior just started working with Russell. And he goes, we meet with Lior. And you know, I had a huge, huge record with Russell. Jimmy Spice, A Dollar Bill, Y'all. I think it was one of his first hit records.
Yeah,
that was on Spring. So Lior, just moved to New York. And it was tough to chase down. And in the meantime, the guy who I went to law school with ended up getting a meeting with Rankin and Bass, which had a cartoon, had the biggest cartoon show on TV.
Jackson 5.
And Thundercats.
Yeah, yeah.
And we sold them on an idea, but they didn't want him to be, they wanted the rappers to be frogs so they could be colorless. So for whatever reason, and it was called the Street Frogs. We got jerked a little bit, but we sued them and we won a little bit of money. Nothing crazy. And then that was really the start of it, where I was just doing my own thing. And then Hiram Hicks was coming to New York after we just won the lawsuit, like a year later or a year and a half later. It was a quick settlement.
Yeah.
And he had Mike Bivens with him. And I said, well, just let's meet at my dad's office. I didn't know where to meet. And I introduced him to my dad and my uncle. And they said, you know, they asked Mike, who's managing you guys? And he says, well, that's why we're here. We're looking for a manager. And make a long story short, we ended up managing New Edition. I brought in my father and uncle just because they had the experience. Me and Hiram were, like I said, 22, 23 years old. And we were about to make the Annie Heartbreak album.
I remember when Hiram was just a photographer.
He was Lady B's boyfriend.
Yeah. No, I remember those times. That's when I first got into the business, that he was a photographer. Yeah.
And I ended up moving to L.A. And that's how really everything pretty much started. I needed money to myself, because we were, you know, we saw a little bit of money with the guys, but you know, they were really just recording. There was no tour happening yet and stuff like that. And I was learning a lot and hanging out at MCA all day. You know, and then I met a guy by the name of Cliff Winston and a woman named Eleanor Williams, and they wanted to do a show with New Edition for Halloween. And I became like an indie on the West Coast just for KJLH. And I did okay, made a little bit of money, and then I hooked up with a company called Delicious Vinyl, and that's when things started to take off for me, promotion wise.
Yeah, Delicious Vinyl was
Tone Loc,
and Young MC. That was massive.
But Brand New Heavies too, and there's a guy named Def Jeff.
Yeah,
so it was amazing. And you know, my first day working up there, Tone Loc, I guess Mike Ross owed him a little bit of money, nothing that you or whatever, but you know, he came strapped, and he was like, yo, where's my money? I'm like, who are you? Like, if you want your money, what are you going to use that on me? He goes, yeah, my friend, you'll never get paid. Like, so it's like, let me call him, you know, and then Mike came to the office, and whatever money Mike, you know, promised him, you know, they got. And to this day, Mike is, you know, one of, you know, still a really close friend of mine.
When you were doing this, is this when you had the promotion company?
Yeah, so this was all the Stephen Rifkin company, right?
Got it.
That's where Fade came in. And Fade's wife was my girlfriend's sister at the time. Fade's future wife.
Yeah.
So it was just me, Fade, and Lisa. And we were in a little office, you know, where Fade worked in the main room. I had a little closet as an office and a bathroom. And that's when we put the whole street team together. And I took my last $3,000 and I sent it to every record company, like from President on down. And I was going to New York for the holidays, and after the holidays, I was going to stay in New York, and I came back, you know, with over six figures worth of business, and that's when we really kicked in.
Yeah, and Fade would call me every week. It was like I had an appointment with him, and that's how I knew what SRC was. Like he would call every week about, you guys had a ton of records.
McDonald's is not new to chicken. So maybe stop questioning their chicken cred and get your hands on the McCrispy. Juicy fried chicken, buttery bun, unmatched pickle to chicken ratio. Yeah, they know what they're doing. In fact, we can honestly say they're not new to chicken. They're true to chicken. The McCrispy. only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
So then when did you get the bug to just kind of create your own label?
I didn't want the label. So I'm making six figures now. So I think I'm making, you know, I think I'm making a fortune. So we had the office and we would close the office from 3 o'clock, which we were on the West Coast, to 5:30. I would go to the park to play ball. We'd meet back at the office at 6. There was a restaurant called Johnny Rockets right across the street from where we are. We would order in some food. We would do out. We would send out daily reports every single day, and we would work back at the office from like 6 to 9 o'clock, and start all over again the next day. So I was cool. I was making six figures. I was playing ball, had a hot girlfriend, and like I was in New York for my cousin's wedding, and I was working at a Jerry Yates office who had a famous artist agency. And he goes, "Why don't you have your label?" I was like, "Man, I don't want a label. I'm good. Like I'm brokering deals. I'm doing this. I'm doing that." He goes, "Well, why don't you meet with this lawyer anyway by the name of Paul Marshall?" And Paul was my dad's attorney. And they just sold Spring at the time. So my dad was doing radio, independent radio, on a national basis. And I met Paul. And he said, "I could get you this deal at BMG. They're starting this new label called Zoo Entertainment. Lou Malia, let him rest in peace, is going to run it." I knew Lou. He was head of Island. And that's where Delicious Vinyl was going through. So I didn't know him well, but I knew him. And he was just a great, great guy. And he says, "I don't have a lot of money." I'm like, "Man, I don't need a lot of money. Like, I'll get this thing up to $100,000, and then you guys kick in. Just help me, give me, you know, some money to make the records and so I could sign the artist." But before that, like I said, I didn't want the label. And I told that to Paul, and Paul called my dad. So I'm staying at Rich's apartment in New York. And my dad calls Rich's apartment, and he's like, "You got to come to the house." So I'm like, "Oh, fuck, something happened now." Right. So I'm like, "Dad, it's 9 o'clock. He goes, "Take the fucking train." And if you know my dad was the nicest guy in the world. But when he got serious, I mean, you know, I couldn't say no. I'll see you tomorrow.
Right.
So I take the train to Long Island. I get there around 11 o'clock, you know, and he's waiting for me. And he's with two of his, I don't know what the fuck, you know, I don't know if they were bodyguard. I don't know what the fuck they were, but they were, you know, two of his guys. And, he goes, "Are you a fucking idiot?" I'm like, "You've told me this before." I'm like, I must be. I'm like, "What do I do now?" He goes, "You turned down a label deal?" And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" I go, "There was no deal. I met with an attorney." He goes, "Yeah, you met with Paul. Paul called me, says you don't want a label." He goes, "Let me explain something to you." He goes, "What you're doing now, you're only as good as your last contract. With a label, you can make money while you're sleeping." And it's probably the first time in my life, because I was so stubborn and so crazy, that I agreed with him. I said, "You know what, Dad, you're right." I think he almost shit on himself. And he goes, "Can I leave now?" He goes, "No, you're going to spend the night, and we're going to go into the city. We're seeing Paul tomorrow at 2 o'clock. I'm like, "What do you mean we're seeing him tomorrow at 2 o'clock? Because I already called him, and I told him I would deal with this. So make a long story short, we see Paul at 2 o'clock. And 2 weeks later, I had a label. It was Zoo Entertainment, which was owned by BMG. A month later, I asked Rich. Rich was a lawyer working at a major, major law firm, and he was miserable being a lawyer. I said, "Why don't you come to LA and work with me? Because you're great at everything that I can't do." And I got the label, I got the promotion company, and he left. You know, the Christmas came, end of the year, and you know, beginning of the year, you know, Rich came, and it was me, Rich, Fade, a guy by the name of Michael Green, Ems, a kid by the name of Garner, and then there was another guy by the name of Rob One, let him rest in peace. He passed. And Lisa, that's when everything started. We put out the Twista was our first artist out of Chicago.
Yeah.
We had Madcap out of L.A. And the Licks. And the Licks at the time was our biggest group.
Yeah. That was sort of your foundation to kind of get started. And then talk a little bit about when, well, what did the Loud, what was Loud the
so,
name?
So Loud, we were, the original offer that before we went was Zoo. I thought I was going to do a deal with Azoff, and his label was called Giant. Right. So Fade came with the name Loud. We did a lot of work with Hank Shopty's label, which was Soul, Sound of Urban Listeners.
Yeah.
And we decided we're going to call ours Listeners of Urban Dialect.
Got it.
And then Loud came, you know, and we had, like, you know, the first three was Twista, Madcap, and the Licks. And in between all that, Zoo ran out of money, and we hit our numbers, And Skip Miller and Ron Urban said, why don't you come to RCA, which was through BMG anyway. And they offered us a little bit more money. And as great as Skip and Ron was, you know, one of the real reasons why we went there was a guy who, you know, by the name of Mojo Nicosia.
Yeah.
And Mojo just had the energy, and he understood us. Like, we never worked records together, like, you know, but we were always like six, you know, inches away from, you know, whatever, 6 degrees of separation.
Yep.
And I've always heard great things about him. When I met him, I was like, man, he's one of us, or we're one of him, you know. And it was like, he, you know, he became our godfather at RCA. And then when Wu-Tang came, you know, it was like, you know, he emptied out his budget for us, you know, and then he went on the road with the guys, and we hired a little bit more people. But it was, you know, and Mojo, you know, he became my brother, and like, you know, just family. And we did whatever we had to do to win.
Well, I'm glad you brought you segged into Wu-Tang, because have you been watching the Wu show on Hulu?
Of course.
Okay, so is it, how accurate is that, the signing of the group? And I know that they had a history of trashing hotel rooms. So did you really bring them to a BMG conference to introduce them, and they trashed the hotel room? Did that really happen?
Oh, yeah. So not only did they trash the hotel room, I think they trashed the fucking hotel.
Yeah.
Like, so you have all of corporate data, right? First of all, they rented out like an old age home. I mean, it was a crazy night. And you had all the Germans in the front row, and Dirty comes out with his legs over, like sitting at the edge of the stage, like with his legs over, and he starts singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow before anybody. And they come running out with water guns and ski masks, like when protecting that kid. And the fucking five leaders of BMG worldwide fall to the floor. And Mojo's with me. He's literally to my right. Rich is on the other side. My brother John's is not even with us yet. And we just laughed. And Mojo goes, why don't you tell me these guys had this type of energy? Let's fucking go. And he was the only one who wasn't scared.
Right.
So.
But you saw, what was it that you saw or heard from them that made you, because you were really the linchpin to, like, you were aggressive to get them, and you didn't have the big budgets like all the other labels.
Sorry for cutting you off. But what I had was, I had the experience of understanding what rap was. You know, we put out the first rap record.
Yeah.
With Fatback Bank Kington III. We had a Jimmy Spicer record. I already saw two records cross over to number one records on the pop charts with Tone Loc and Young MC. And we had the Streets. I mean, nobody had a street team then, really. And that's, as you know, I mean, Faye would call you with, like, what, 20 records, 15 records?
20 records.
At any given fucking time. So the only thing, I promised Drizza was, I don't have the money, but what I'm going to do is just attack the streets. And I said, I'll come to New York for the summer. I was living in WGA, that started in L.A. I came to New York. He would show up at the office every single day with a notepad. He said, these are the things that we have to do. Like, I think we should put a street team in Cincinnati. So we would hire somebody. He goes, why are you saying yes to everything I'm asking for? And I said, because it's making sense. I wasn't, like, playing. And, like, we had success with the Alcoholics. Even though I was living in L.A., I'm from New York, man. It's like, I had to have something in New York. My family was still there, you know.
Right.
And that was it. Trevor Williams, who started off as an intern and a promotion guy for me, he's the one that found the guys through Jason Staten, who was a college radio DJ out of Flint, Michigan. That's how we found the record.
And so you get Wu-Tang on, and you craft a deal, which is actually kind of a brilliant deal, that you sign them as a group, but they could go elsewhere and sign solo deals. And you got a couple of them on solo deals, but you could tap into the marketing of all these other companies for Wu-Tang. Like, it was just brilliant. Like, did you know that that's what you were doing?
Well, this is what I knew. I knew the group is always bigger than the solo. Right. Except maybe if you're Michael Jackson and a Jackson 5. Right. But at the end of the day, like, when Mick Jagger went solo, he wasn't bigger than the Rolling Stones. When John Lennon went solo, he wasn't bigger than the Beatles. I even think when Justin Timberlake went solo, I still think NSYNC might have been bigger, you know, and just Michael was Michael, and I was taking the chance that the group would have still been bigger than the whole. And right. as you just said 5 minutes ago, it gave us the opportunity to deal with every label who signed. If it was Wendy Goldstein signing GZA and Tracy Waples and Lior signing Meth and Sylvia and Merlin, I think it was Merlin. Merlin Bob. And Dante Ross.
Oh, Dante Ross, okay.
Signing Dirty.
Electra.
You know, and they were paying me a shitload of money to promote these records. And to like
So you were still doing a promotion while you had Loud and it was taking off?
Yeah, I had the promotion company up until 1999 when I sold Loud to Sony, and that's when I had to stop it and I had to sell the promotion company.
Okay, so that makes all the sense in the world. So you were able to really kind of get them going. And the first album was a phenomenal success. That would probably be the big lift that you got. Did things change between you and BMG when that album came out?
Man, when that album came out, what? November 9th, 1993, right?
Yep.
And by the time Raekwon's album came, which was August 1995, I might have changed the deal 5 times, but that time I must have changed the deal 3 times alone, just with Wu-Tang, and then we came with the Mobb Deep record and the Flex record. Like every time we had a smell of a hit, we were coming in. I mean, they hated us.
McDonald's is not new to chicken, so maybe stop questioning their chicken cred and get your hands on the McCrispy, juicy fried chicken, buttery bun, unmatched pickle to chicken ratio. Yeah, they know what they're doing. In fact, we can honestly say they're not new to chicken. They're true to chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Yeah.
I mean, they hated us and loved us at the same time.
Yeah. Let's talk about Mobb Deep, though, because Mobb Deep was on Island at first, and they were like little kids. I remember them because they had hit it from the back.
Yep.
And you signed them, but you tapped into something with them that was just undeniable, like success. Like they were the streets, I guess, as you say. But their and it probably started with Havoc, but their beats, their energy, their vibe. I mean, they were a special type of group. Talk a little bit about why you got them from Island and how that came about.
Island released them, and then I just hired. At that time, I already hired a guy by the name of Stretch Armstrong. Who was a huge DJ in New York.
Stretch and Bobbito,
Stretch and Bobbito. And then he said, you know, these guys are clear. And then Stretch introduced me to a guy by the name of Scott Free. And then Free introduced me to Matty C, who was working for The Sauce. And they became my nucleus of my A&R team. You know, Matty had the unsigned type at The Sauce. And, like, you know, he's the one that really found Biggie and gave Biggie the Puff. So the three of them, like, were just, you got to sign him. And then when I met Hav, just how he came in, Prodigy, you know, let him rest in peace, had sickle cell, he was sick. So Hav came, you know, with the crew, and they created Havoc. No, you know, just like in the building, we were working at a bar CA in New York. And I was like, this is going to be the perfect follow-up for Wu-Tang.
And I also think it was funny that you put your little brother became part of the label, and you sent him on the road with Mobb Deep. And I'll never forget, they did a promo date for me in Philly. There's this really grimy club in downtown Philly called The Fever. It was just wild in there. And so, like, they were in the VIP area, and they were watching.
Well, him and Mojo, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah.
They went together. They were at each other's hip 24/7.
Yep. And so the guys were watching the kids fighting. And then they started fighting amongst themselves because they were like, oh, we want to fight. And then we put them in a hotel room. And I don't know how they did this or whatever, but like half the bathroom door was missing. And Jonathan was so stressed because they weren't paying him no mind. And I was like, oh, man, your brother set you up. He set you up. And that was the first project with them. But then they came and had tremendous success. And one other story, too, about you. So when you first got Wu-Tang and you signed them, there was two moments that I remember. One, you sent them to the Impact Convention in Atlantic City. And
I didn't send them. They went on their own because it was just a single deal. And Sincere gave him the fucking credit card. And Sincere called me like on Monday or Tuesday. He goes, are you going to pay me back? I'm like, for what? He goes, they just spent $70,000 or $80,000 on my credit card ordering lobster champagne. I'm like, sincere.
Yeah.
I have no idea what the fuck you're talking about.
I just happened to be with him the next morning when he found out that he basically let them in the room and they just ordered a bunch of shit in the room, trashed the room, but ordered everything that you could imagine. And he was just so stressed. But then I also, when they first came to Philly, when I interviewed them and I shared this on my podcast episode about them, they trashed the radio station. You put them in a, not you, but whoever, put them in a van in Staten Island and left New York at like 4 o'clock on a Friday. Of course, the traffic was insane to get to Philadelphia. They get to Philly, they haven't eaten. So we have a vending machine and they just annihilate the vending machine. It's just shit all up and down the hallway. And it was the day before Hiram's wedding because you sat next to my boss, Dave Allen, who gave you an earful about what they did the night before at the station. And then a couple years later, ODB, on the eve of his debut album, solo album, he's drunk, shows up to the station, spills Alizé all in my board at 11 o'clock at night. I mean, I've got so many Wu-Tang stories that like I probably should have lost my job because these guys were out of control. But how did you all like harness that energy and keep your sanity? Because it was always something between Mobb Deep and Wu-Tang.
I mean, you know, this is where I really take my hat off to my dad. He goes, like, I would get nuts. He goes, Steven, what did you do? You robbed, you stole, you trashed. Like, it's patience. I mean, you know, it wasn't a lot of money that they got, but they got money legitimately for the first time. And they weren't doing it harm. I mean, they weren't doing it out of evilness. They were doing it just, they became rock stars.
Right.
You know,
right.
And it's not like, you know, they didn't become stars after their third single. They became a star fucking immediately. RZA and GZA took a minute, you know, when RZA was signed to Tommy Boy and GZA was signed to Cold Chillin'. But at the end of the fucking day, it was like, are you allowed to curse?
Yeah.
Okay.
You've been cursing the whole time.
Oh, I got you. So it was like, you know, it happened so quick for all of us. Like, you know, one day it was like, boom. And, you know, and the next day, you know, we're talking about millions of dollars.
So talk about the setup for the second Wu-Tang album, which was probably one of the most anticipated hip-hop albums up to that point in 97. It was a double album. I couldn't only imagine you and your preparedness for releasing that album, how massive you knew that it was going to be for your company.
I was getting married in July 3rd, 1997. And the fiscal year for BMG, it was at the end. It went from, you know, July 1st to the end of June. We gave our word to BMG that we would drop the album. So I think, I forget when the album came out, say June 23rd or June 17th. But before that, the negotiation was not a crazy negotiation, but, you know, we were supposed to be negotiating against each other. But me and RZA said, no, we're going in together. Because I already told you, I already changed my deal 3 or 4 times.
Right.
And we were $20,000 away from closing the Raekwon deal, and BMG was holding their ground. And I said, just give them the fucking money. And there was a woman, I never hit a woman in my life, I still haven't. And she goes, Steven Rifkin, I'm tired of your shit, go fuck yourself. And we're in the 36th floor, and she was head of business affairs for RSA. We're in the 36th floor conference room, and I still had my temper. And I take a chair, and I'm ready to throw it through the window, but that's facing Broadway. And I'm like, oh. And I stopped it. I dislocated my thumb. I stopped the chair, and I turned around, and I threw it through the glass door facing the hallway. She freaked out. She called the cops. I got arrested. And I just found out my future wife was pregnant with my first son 4 or 5 days. So I was probably a little stressed about that, too.
Right.
And RZA said, he called me that night when I got home. And he says, we're going to sign with you. Let's play it out for the holidays. And let's just milk them. And it worked to perfection, you know, where RZA got really what he wanted for Ray, which was $400,000 more. And then he got millions for the second album. And like I said, and then I changed my shit around. And then when we signed the deal for the second album fully, that's when I got the biggest check of my life too. And so that was a story in itself. And then the guys came out to LA to make the record, a double album, as you said. And I thought the setup was amazing. We locked up a tour with Rage Against the Machine. And I was like, all right, this is going to be the perfect tour. And it wasn't going to really be your opening act, of course. But when they came on, the place was already sold out. We were doing like 25,000 outdoor sheds. And I just figured the album was going to do 12 to 14 million, and it was a double album. So it was good, you know, you double that. So I was thinking it was going to do 28, you know, to 30 million. And we're doing my prenup at the same time. And they were like, you know, I'm expecting this amount of money to come in. And I mean, it was just a fucking, was really just a clusterfuck. And then they jumped off the tour because they weren't getting, they saw all the money that they were getting. I mean, not the money they were getting. They weren't getting a lot of money for the tour, but they saw the crowds. And as we were going into the Midwest and cities that they'd never been before, that's when everything, and it was starting to kick in. We were averaging 200,000 a week. There's really no more sound scan, but we were averaging 2,000 fucking a week sales. And they, I said, we're not doing the tour anymore. But we still did crazy numbers. We still did 10 million at the end of the day, which was equivalent to shit, $100 million.
Then at that point, like a couple years later, you end up selling the company. What made you decide to finally do that in 1999?
I really didn't want to do it, but they were so numbers-based. I had the best record company in the world at that time, creatively-wise, music-wise. You know, Jimmy Iovine was one of my mentors. And, you know, Interscope was one of my biggest accounts.
Right.
And he kept on saying, fuck the bottom line. Just worry about the top line. They're making so much fucking money off you. It does, you know, it doesn't even matter. So when they said, you know, we want more profits, I was like, fuck you. Because they already fucked us on money regarding my prenup. And I'm like, I'm not worrying about profits. I got to build this company. Well, we'll let you guys go then. And, you know, Tommy came. He goes, I want to buy. He bought 70% of the company, but you got to run this since we're making this the third major inside the Sony system.
Right.
You got to run this full time. You can't have your marketing company. It was the greatest thing and the biggest mistake of my life all at the same time.
Why was it the biggest mistake?
Sony was just too corporate. We went from like 35 of the most creative people in the business to fucking 300 people in a day. And it was just like, people were calling, I'm 37 years old, people were calling me Mr. Rifkin. And I was just like, I cried. Like, and it wasn't out of happiness. So it was like, I made the biggest mistake of my life.
So then you eventually leave the situation, right?
Yeah, I left or I got fired or whatever it was. But I, you know, my contract was up and I started SRC Records with Doug and Mello Winter and Monty Lippman and Kadar Massenburg.
Yeah. Now, what kind of, was that a really good, did you learn from your Loud days? So that deal, was that a much better favorable deal to you?
No, because I had the reputation of not giving a shit because Jimmy told him I didn't give a shit about the fucking bottom line. Jimmy became a corporate guy after fucking listening to him. So I just said, I'm not match you dollar for dollar, but I'm going to put, you know, I'm going to have my own skin in the game too. You know, it's like, when I told them Akon will be the biggest artist of my career, they laughed in my face. And I said, you know, I still had my temper. I was like, fuck you. And me, and at that time, my right hand was a guy by the name of Gabby Acevedo.
Yeah.
And Gabby took Akon and did, his wife was pregnant at the time. He did the East Coast and the Northeast. And I did the West Coast and then, you know, the Southwest or Northwest with Akon's brother, Boo. And then we didn't have a video at the time. So nobody knew what Akon looked like. And we were just doubling down on dates. And the record broke out of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Utah at some rhythm stations. We locked up.
Before that, you had David Banner, though. David Banner was
a formidable
artist.
Yeah. I mean, he had the record. It was funny. It was Little Flip was the last thing I signed to Loud. And Banner, you know, with the Like a Pimp, had a Little Flip on the record.
McDonald's is not new to chicken. So maybe stop questioning their chicken cred and get your hands on the McCrispy. Juicy fried chicken, buttery bun, unmatched pickle to chicken ratio. Yeah, they know what they're doing. In fact, we can honestly say they're not new to chicken. They're true to chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
And then you had Terror Squad, which... you know, in 2004, Lean Back was one of the biggest. That's still one of the biggest hip hop records ever. Talk a little bit about that deal with Fat Joe, because he was an Atlantic artist. So you signed Terror Squad as a.
So, yeah. So don't forget, we had major success with Joe with Pun.
Right. So correct.
Me and Joe, you know, we became family overnight. I mean, I don't even know how people knew, but like I was in Chicago when I met him over the phone. And by the time the meeting was like the following Tuesday, people were saying, don't take a meeting with him. He's a bad guy. He's an extortionist, this, that, or whatever. I was like, nah, fuck that. Like, I just loved his energy on the phone. And when he came to the office, I was like, let me talk to you privately for a second. I told him. And I said, it doesn't scare me. And, you know, I respect the gangster, you know, because all they have is their word. And we hit it off. He was fighting with Atlantic at the time. And he said, let me just, he called me and he says, I want to do this Terror Squad album, this, that, or whatever. He goes, where are you? I said, LA. I said, I'll come to New York. I'll meet you in New York. He was in Miami. And he played me 3 or 4 songs. Lean Back was one of them. And it was just like, I knew, you know, that we were going to have history again.
Yeah. Did you enjoy the second run with Universal more than the Loud Run, initial Loud Run? Or was that something that just can't be replaced for you career-wise?
It was two different things, right? So Loud was truly the coolest label that you could possibly think of, right? The people that worked for it, everything else like that. SRC was a little bit more corporate and a lot smaller because we relied on Universal for a lot of stuff.
Right.
But we still had a great creative team. It was me, Gabby Acevedo, Rich came back, Isaacson came back, my brother came back. Jason Campana, who I think is now head of Tidal, started off as my assistant and ended up as our GM. Matt Maroney, Kirk Harding, who was head of international at Loud, came as like our head of marketing, and you know, and we just had it was like a staff of 10 to 12 people, but it was cool. And we had, like, they gave us a whole section on the 7th floor at the Universal building.
Do you find, after you've had all, I mean, you, most people can't do what you did one time, but you did it two times in two different systems. Do you find that you now provide counsel to a lot of the other people that have tried to follow those blueprints and start their own labels, and especially in the hip hop space?
Knowledge is power, right? So if I could help you do it, you know, then it's more power for me. I'm not, you know, I'm not the type of guy that keeps everything inside of me. So I'm really about, if I could help you, and eventually if I need something, a favor out of you, knowing the type of person you are, you're going to be able to help, you know, me if I need something. So I was always open to sharing as much information as possible. To this day, like, my Karen, when he left Atlantic, called me like 4 or 5 months before he called. And he's like, you know, and I didn't charge him. I didn't do anything. I was like, Mike, this is what you got to do.
Right.
You know, right. And he put his 2 cents and his own spin on it. But that's, you know, what we did.
What do you think of music today? What do you think will happen to the music business? You know, if you could look at how things work today and how much money is generated, you know, what do you think about it?
I mean, I'm ecstatic for Coach and P. I'm ecstatic for Top Dog. I'm ecstatic for NBA YoungBoy. You know, I don't personally, like, on some of the records, I don't understand it, you know, yeah. but at the end of the day, you know, I'm in it. So yeah. Do I need to really understand it anymore? I mean, that's why I got my sons, you know, my daughter, you know, and I got a great, you know, nucleus of friends around me that helped me. You know, there's a guy by the name of Dana Biondi who manages the Suicide Boys, you know, and they're the biggest independent streaming artist out there, you know, and I'm, you know, and like I said, you're never too old to learn.
Right.
Right. So, you know, the one thing I have going for is, like, my nucleus, you know, Mojo is still, you know, part of this Spring Sound, and he's mentoring my son. You know, my son played college basketball, so he's pretty disciplined, you know, and his work ethic is really second to none. You know, my daughter's going to be going to law school, and eventually she'll be running the company. And my youngest son, you know, he put out a record around a year and a half ago himself, and he got it up to 1 million to 2 million streams, but he wants to take a different path, but creatively, you know, he's still with us. So,
that's great.
Yeah. So I'm open to just listen, I don't have the answers anymore, but I could give it, you know, how it was back in the day. But I'm more about listening and just asking questions now and finding the records that I think could go.
But if you think about it, Steve, what you just said about, you know, like you didn't understand it, like that's what people would say about Loud. I mean, you signed Dead Presidents. People listen to that and they Dead Prez. They were like, what is that? You signed out of Memphis.
3-6.
Yeah, 3-6 Mafia. I mean, just that whole, nobody was touching that. But you saw something there and you was like, oh, I can do something. And then these guys win a friggin' Oscar. Like, that's insane.
There's luck, my instinct. You know, I don't know what you want to call it, but, you know, I got a kid now. Like, Clove, I sit here and I go to my, like, who can I fucking call? And he's like, chill, relax. Like, and I sit here twiddling my thumbs all day, frustrated, trying to do more. He's like, man, just relax. So they called me like 3 weeks ago to call somebody to see if, you know, we could get a playlist, you know, and I got the playlist, and you know, this kid in the beginning of the year, he had maybe 20 followers on TikTok. Now he is close to 400,000. He had 0 monthly listeners on Spotify, and we're closing in on 200,000 now. And the kid's going to break. But back in the day, I could tell you the exact time and when he would break.
Right
now, I just sit here like, waiting for Alex, my son, or somebody to call me and say, hey, it's go time. So that's really what it is. So I'm mentoring Alex. I tell him old stories. He loves to hear stories about my dad, you know, we're working, or he's really working, and I'm just trying to figure this shit out as we go now.
Well, Steve, man, thank you so much for giving me some time today. Yeah. I mean, I just had an honor of just watching you and watching this whole thing happen in real time and interacting with you all along this journey. And I'm glad that you got your flowers on the BET Hip Hop Awards. That was a massive moment. And it literally gave me goosebumps just seeing one label that could create all of that kind of energy. And then we didn't even talk about Pun. So then you had Pun, which was massive. And then you, start another label and do it all over again and have an artist like Akon. It's pretty impressive, man. And what a great legacy. And we just look forward to seeing what you and your family do down the line. And, just keep sharing this information, man, because what an amazing story. We need the Steven Rifkin movie. We need the Loud movie. We got a documentary.
We're working on some things.
We need to see. I was gonna say we need to see this, man. We gotta see it play out.
You gotta thank RZA for that. Yeah. So Club was great seeing it. I think the last time I saw you was in the Bahamas.
Yeah. You was with Gabrielle Union and Essence Atkins because my daughter was like she was like a year old, but she's like 16 and in college now. So that shows you how long long it's been.
Yeah.
Sure. But listen, man, great to see you congratulations and thanks for doing the backstory.
No, man, this was great. A lot of fun.
Coming up on the next Backstory Podcast, musical legend Ron Isley.
The Beatles did Twist and Shout. That was our second biggest hit. And we went over in England and we came back and went to Motown and did This Old Heart of Mine and wanted to have our own thing like Berry Gordy. And we decided, because we lived in Teaneck, New Jersey, Teaneck Records.
The Backstory Podcast with Colby Kolb is an Urban One Incorporated Reach Media Pod is Good production, hosted and executive produced by yours truly, Colby Kolb, edited by Donkus. Follow us on Twitter at BackstoryPCC, on Instagram, Get the Backstory. Senior Director of Podcast Operations, Sierra Reed, for Sales and Corporate Partnerships, Josh Romani and Michelle Marino. Digital Marketing, Walter Gaynor, J.R. Smith, and Tim Hall. Thanks again for listening to the Backstory Podcast.